with the Parsha of Baalosecha, its opening, we meet the menorah for the third time in the Chumash. It keeps on appearing. First in Chumash Shemos, then in Chumash Beikra, and the third time here in Chumash Bamidbar. That's
excuse me. They'd like to make a separation.
That's what they call the good innings in the Torah. And it's interesting to pay attention, as we always try to do, to the details of the psukim. Parsha begins by Daber Hashem al Moshe Lemor. Hashem speaks to Moshe, Daber el Aharon ba'amata elav. Speak to Aharon, say to him, Ba'alosecha Saneros, when you raise the lights, when you kindle the lights, el mul panei ha-menorah, ya'iru shiva saneros. All seven shall face inwards. Question we've discussed in the past, how can all seven face inwards? One of them is the inwards. Six of them can face inwards. That's a question for the Mefarshim. But a favorite question among certain Mefarshim, as a matter of course, is always to pay attention to the expressions of Dibur and Amira. As we know, they're not exactly the same. Dibur has a certain harsh, or shall we say, business-like connotation, whereas Amira has a softer, a milder, a friendlier tone to it. In the words of Rashi, actually based in this week's Parsha, at the beginning of Perek Yud Beis, Dibur is Lashon Kosha, Amira is Lashon Raka. And interesting, therefore, if when we see them together, Daber el Aharon, the Amarta Elav. What is the message to Aaron? Is it a business message or is it a pleasant message? Well, apparently the answer is yes, but we need to find out exactly how. Now, interestingly, the very association of Aaron with the menorah is not a simple matter at all. For the simple reason that if we know the halacha, it states that lighting the menorah does not require a Kohen Gadol, it does not even require a Kohen. Hadlaka bizar, kishera. Lighting the menorah through a non-Kohen is acceptable. It could be rather tricky for him actually to get into the Mishkan. I mean, that he could encounter other religious issues there. But if somehow that can be overcome, and there were times, not frequently, where the menorah was not actually in the Mishkan, but there was still a mitzvah to light it. Indeed, although this is a chiddush, it is the simple reading of the Siddur, where we say in Alanisim for Chanukah, we know the words, V'achakem ba'ovanecha, ledvirbesecha, finusecha lecha, tiris mikdashecha, v'hidliku neiros, bechatzos kachecha. They lit the neiros, bechatzos kachecha, sounds like in the courtyard. And the question is, what does that mean? The menorah is lit in the courtyard? I thought the menorah is lit in the Mishkan. Well, says the Chasam Sofer, generally, but not then. They took the menorah outside the Mishkan and they lit it in the courtyard. Why? Well, for reasons that are very much associated with Chanukah. Pirsumei Nisa. To publicize the miracle, as long as it's in the Mishkan, no one can see. They took it out the Mishkan, v'dliku neiros v'chatzos kachecha. Under such circumstances, even a non-Kohen could light. Those are technicalities, but the fact remains, it is not something, it is one of almost the exceptional items within the Mishkan that does not need a Kohen. And here is Aaron, and he's told, when you light the menorah, but who tells Aaron that he's the one that needs to light the menorah at all? So there are two quite different approaches to this question. We'll begin at the end and then work backwards. Meshech Chochma has a disarmingly simple approach. It is true, says Meshech Chochma, that the menorah does not need to be lit by a Kohen. Not normally. But there was one time in history that it did require a Kohen specifically. And that is with regards to Chinuch. Every aspect of the Mishkan and every vessel of the Mishkan, it needs to be inaugurated. And the inauguration tends to take the form of using it in its capacity, in its Mishkan capacity, for the first time. Says the Gemara in Maseches Menachos, B'daf Memtes, when it comes to the chinuch of the menorah, for that you need a Kohen. Aha. So we have discovered at least one situation where the lighting of the menorah would require a Kohen specifically. The question is, how do we know that our parsha is talking about inaugurating the menorah? Perhaps it's talking about a later date. Well, to that, says Meshe Chachma, if you've read your Rashi, you'll understand that we are talking about the inauguration of the menorah. Because Rashi famously darshans the juxtaposition of our parsha, the menorah, with the end of Parshas Noso, which you could not fail to hear in Shul last week, the Chanukas HaNesiim, and my inyan Chanukah Nesiim, Etzel Aaron. And Rashi says, because Aaron, he saw each of the tribes, they were involved in the inauguration of the Mishkan, but he wasn't, for some reason, he was not involved, and he became despondent, until Hashem consoled him, so to speak, and compensated him with the Parsha of Menorah. Says Meshe Chochma, what Aaron, now Aaron is not missing things to do in the Mishkan. Most of the things that happen in the Mishkan can only happen through Aaron, which means clearly what Aaron feels that he's been left out of is Chanukas HaMishkan, is the inaugurational stage of the Mishkan. Well, if that's what he's missing out on, then when Hashem compensates him with the menorah, clearly it's not going to be the ongoing lighting of the menorah, but specifically the Chanukas HaMenorah. And that, says Meshe Chochma, as we've established from the Gemara, is something that requires a Kohen specifically. Thus does Aaron come to be exclusively bound up with Hadlokas HaNer. The Chanukas HaNer requires Aaron. From that point onwards, anyone can do it. Now, there is a separate approach, which is much from much earlier on, from the Ritva. In Maseches Yuma on Daf Kaf Dalet, he raises the question himself. It's a well-known question: why is the pasuk associating Aaron? Is the halacha not that that a hadlaka doesn't need a Kohen? And the Ritva's answer, in its own way, is very simple. I mean, once he says it, it's very simple. And that is, our question is: a menorah doesn't need a Kohen, even if a non-Kohen lights, it's kosher. That's true, says Ritva. And the Pasuk never says otherwise. The Pasuk never says, Daber el Aaron ve'amarta elav ta'ale es haneiros. The Pasuk never instructs Aaron to light the menorah. The Pasuk only says to Aaron, when you light the menorah, this is the way to do it. El mul p'nei ha-menorah, you see to it that all of the lights face towards the middle. In other words, what the Ritva is pointing out is that not everything that's written in the Torah is a command. And moreover, not everything that's written in the Torah, even with reference to commandments, is a command. In order for something to be a mitzvah, the Torah needs to express it in a beloshon tzivui, to say, this should happen, or do the following. Here, no one told Aaron to light the menorah. What Hashem said to Aaron is, when you light the menorah, this is the way to do it. That's called Lashon Sipur. That's a narrative, not an imperative. And therefore, that does not in any way conflict with the halacha, as we know it, that it does not need Aaron specifically to light the menorah. The question at that point is, well, if you don't need Aaron, so then what exactly is Hashem doing by describing him as lighting the menorah? Say the Mefarshim, what Aaron is being given is the right to light the menorah, as if to say there are certain avodos only Aaron could do, or only a Kohen can do. Lighting the menorah is not something only Aaron can do, but he's associated with it descriptively because he has the right to light the menorah before anyone else. And that is the compensation for Aaron. And perhaps we may suggest, although there's many, many different ways one could say this, that this is why the opening section of Parshas Balosecha, it has Loshen Dibur and it has Loshen Amira. Daber el Aaron, the amarta elav. Daber is a mitzvah. Amira is something more encouraging. The question is, how is Aaron being addressed? He's being commanded to do something? Is he being encouraged? But here we see that it's a blend, because the issue being discussed is a mitzvah, but he's not being commanded. So on the one hand, the base is Daber el Aaron, because we're talking about a mitzvah, but the news for Aaron is, you don't have to do this mitzvah. Anyone can do it. But if you want, you have the right to do it. And that's already a privilege for Aaron. And that's why Daber el Aaron, the business side of things, is followed up with Va'omarta, which is the more encouraging side of things. So these are a few words with reference to the beginning of the parasha, the third appearance of the menorah in the Torah. Now I'd like to move from here to discuss one of the classic mitzvahs of Parshas Baal Osachar, and that's the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni, which came about through Pesach Rishon. And as we know, the background is in Perek Tes, B'nai Yisrael are commanded to bring the Korban Pesach for this year. They did not bring the Korban Pesach in subsequent years, but they brought it in this year. And even in that first year, there were certain people that were unable to bring the Korban Pesach. There's a whole discussion as to who they were, why were they Tomei, who were they Tomei for? I mean, that's just bad timing. Who are they? They're the ones that dealt with Yosef's coffin, or they're the ones that dealt with Nadav and Avihu. That's a discussion in the Gemara and Sukkah and Daf Kaf He. But that was their matzav. The mitzvah of Korban Pesach is given, and they will not be able to partake of it. Amazingly, they do not keep quiet. They approach the bench, and they come to Moshe, and they lodge a complaint, which can only really be summed up, I think, in the modern Hebrew expression, which says, "Ze lo fair," which loosely translated is, it's not fair. Because here we are, we're Tamein and Nefesh Adam, we did the right thing, and now we're losing out. Lama nigara. So that's already a chiddush that they felt that they could complain. As far as we know, sometimes it happens that way. And if you can't do it, you can't do it. But they were adamant. And more amazingly, the response was forthcoming that they were the catalyst for a new mitzvah being transmitted, which is Pesach Sheni. And let us see how Pesach Sheni is introduced in the Torah, which is in Perek Tes, Pasuk Yud. Daber al b'nei Yisrael le'mor. Ish. Pasuk Yud. Ish ki yet tamei lenefesh. If you have any person who is become tamei for a mace, into contact with the deceased, obeder chochoka, or he's on a faraway journey, lachem adar seichem, for you or for your generations, the va'asa pesach lashem, he can still do pesach b'chodesh hasheni, in the second month, the 14th of Iyar, what we call Pesach Sheni. So Pesach Sheni is given, the opportunity is given for a person who is either Tomei, as they were, but also Derech Rechoka, far away. He's too far, he can't get to the Beis HaMikdash. There's too much distance between him and the Beis HaMikdash. And the question, of course, that everyone is keen to know is, how far is far? Derech Rechoka, it's far. Okay. And it is actually the subject of a dispute in the Mishnah, in Maseches Pesachim, in the ninth perek, in the Gemara on Daf Tzadikim Alamed Beis. Ezori derech rechoka, how far is far? So we have two opinions, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Akiva's distance is much greater. Ezori derech rechoka, min hamodiim velachutz. Anything from modiim and onwards, and beyond, ukemidas de la karuach, and the equivalent distance in all directions. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. Now we'll come back to Rabbi Akiva, but that's his modin, from modin and onwards, in all directions. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, meiskupas ha'azara velachutz. Rabbi Eliezer says, no, even if he's just outside, the entrance of the temple courtyard, that's still too far. If he didn't make it, it's still too far. Now, of course, Rabbi Akiva seems to be more in keeping with the simple translation of Derech Rechoka. I mean, everything's relative, but Rechoka sounds like it's far. I mean, it really depends where you are, what's called Rechoka. And if you live in Yerushalayim and you travel far to get to Shul, it means you travel two blocks, and you've already passed eight shuls. So the shul that's far away is different metrics. But what's behind Rabbi Akiva? So as Mefarshim explain, Rabbi Kiva rates distance in terms of the beginning time that one can bring the Korban Pesach is Chatzos, roughly, give or take, Chatzos of Erev Pesach. If a person is at Modi'in on Chatzos of Erev Pesach, without getting into the discussion as to whether Modi'in of nowadays is the Modi'in that Rabbi Kiva is talking about, historians and their fellows can work that out. But if a person would start to walk from Modi'in, he would get to Yerushalayim in time to bring the Korban Pesach. That's why it's considered to be not that far. But if he's too far and the average walk would not get him to the Beis HaMikdash on time, so that's called Derech Rechok. So that's Rabbi Akiva. You've got to define far, and that's how he defines far. But Rabbi Eliezer doesn't seem to define far, because even if he's in the, a few hundred meters away, or a few dozen meters away, but he didn't make it to the base of it, it's already called far. Okay. Now Rabbi Yossi adds something here. Lefichach nakud al hay. That's why there's a dot on the hay. If you look at the word Derech Rechoka and look at the hay on Derech Rechoka, you will see that there's a nekuda. And the nekuda always has a message. And the message comes to diminish the impact of the word, which means that Rechoka without the hay, far is far. But, pardon me, without the dot means Rechoka, far. But with the dot means not that far, and perhaps really not that far at all. It still has the atmosphere of Rechoka because he was prevented from getting there. But it's not really about distance. That's what the dot on the hay tells us. So says Rabbi Yossi, in support of Rabbi Eliezer. So if you look at the dot, everything changes. Lo mipnei sherachok vadai. It's not because he's really far. He's just outside the Azara. He just didn't make it. Now, to summarize, the Pasuk says, Derech Rechoka. If it's for Pesach Sheni, it's for someone who was far on the Pesach Rishon. How far is far? Rabbi Kiva seems to go, if we may say, Kipshuto, far means far, however far that is, from Modi'in and beyond. And Rabbi Eliezer seems to be not so much Kipshuto, but there's that dot, and he takes it into account. Okay. Now, if we come to ask who the Halacha is, like, well, there's no Shulchan Aruch on Hilchos Korban Pesach, but there is Rambam, and Rambam paskens like Rabbi Akiva that it's about Modi'in and beyond, which is no surprise. Generally speaking, in the machlokus between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, the halacha will be like Rabbi Akiva. So the halacha is far means far. Okay? But set against that background, we now consult Rashi's comment on Derech Rechoka. And Rashi says, you know, Nakudalav, says Rashi. Look, there's a dot on top of the word Rechoka. Lomar comes to teach you something. Lo Rechoka Vadai, that it doesn't mean literally far. He was just outside the Azara and couldn't make it inside. That's very interesting. Rashi has thrown his lot in with Rabbi Eliezer. And in so doing, he attracts the critique of the Ramban. Ramban says, how can you do this? How can you say that? How can you explain the Pasuk this way? And Ramban's critique is twofold. Number one, it's not the Halacha. The Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. Rashi is explaining the Pasuk not like the Halacha, like Rabbi Eliezer. It's number one. Which actually, if we may pause for a moment in between the two questions, is an easier question to deal with. For the simple reason that Rashi's job in his commentary on the Torah is not to paskan halachas. Rashi's job in Shul is to paskan halachas. In his Shelos Utshuvos is to paskan halachas. But in his Pirush on the Torah is to explain to you the Pshat in the Pasuk. And if the Pshat, the straighter line of Pshat, is not in accord with the halacha, so be it. And that's a common phenomenon within Rashi. So that's actually milder. I think the Ramban is building up really to the second question is, it's not Pshat either. I mean, with all due respect to the dots, that's not Pshat. Rachok means Rachok. It means far. I mean, that's a translation. So Rashi just seems to have missed all metrics of what should allow something to be into his commentary. It's not the halacha, okay, and moreover, it's not even the pshat. So you can't even say he compromised on the halachically accepted position because he preferred the straighter path according to pshat. It's not the straighter path according to either of them. So these are quite serious charges leveled against Rashi. And as we can appreciate, there are a good few many commentators who are not going to just let this go without comment. But rather, they proceed to explain why it is that Rashi feels that actually Rabbi Eliezer's approach, that is, not really that far, is the pshat. It is closer to pshat. Okay. How so? Let us present three approaches. And again, to be clear, we are looking to understand why Rashi preferred Rabbi Eliezer for pshat reasons, that Rechoka doesn't really mean that far. Well, the first up is the Maskil David, Rabbi David Pardo's famous classic commentary on Rashi, Maskil David. And Rabbi David Pardo says, Rashi, you know, sometimes when you want to understand the pshat of something, you need to look a bit broader. That is to say, perhaps the full picture will emerge when you see the whole context. What do we mean by that? It is true that Pasuk Yud refers to Pesach Sheni as given to someone who is Tomei or Bederech Rechoka. It is true. Tomei we've dealt with, we'll put that to the side. Derech Rechoka, he's far away. It's true. But then look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, which talks about a person who does not qualify. What about Ha'ish Ashehu Tahor? This is not Tomei. Uvederech Lo Haya. And he wasn't on the derech. He wasn't on the way. Then, says the Pasuk, paraphrasing, he's in trouble. He doesn't bring the Korban Pesach. But says Maskil David, I would like to ask a very simple question. If it's true that derech rechoka really means a long journey, a long distance, and only if you're a long distance away are you eligible, then when the Pasuk talks about someone who's not eligible, how can it let it go by saying, and he wasn't baderech? It should have said, correspondingly, uvaderech rechoka lo haya, because that's of the essence. He needs to be far away in order to qualify. But the Pasuk doesn't say, the second time around, uvaderech rechoka lo haya. What does that tell us? It tells us that even the first time around, derech rechoka, it doesn't mean literally far away. It means he's not there, he wasn't able to make it, even if he's close by. And you see that as the Pasuk reiterates, it even drops the word rechoka because it's about the fact that he wasn't in the Beis HaMikdash for whatever reason, not how far away he is. So that's actually a chiddush. Because really for Maskil David, Rashi's comment on Pasuk Yud, that Rechoka doesn't really mean far, is with an eye on Pasuk Yud Gimel. Rashi doesn't always work that way. Our notion of Rashi is that generally he tends to take the psukim that are in front of him and the words that are in front of him as they are. And then when he gets later on, then he'll discuss... the later Pasuk. So to say that a later Pasuk is already informing and shaping and influencing Rashi's comment on the earlier Pasuk, that's a statement. But that's Maskil David. A very different approach is to be found in another of the great Mefarshei Rashi, the Be'er Basodeh. Be'er Basodeh, Rav Menachem Danun, is actually a Talmud of the Maskil David. So he has from his Rebbe, but he has plenty to say of himself. It says, Be'er Basodeh, let's go back to Pasuk Yud and perhaps note a phrase that we haven't really paid that much attention to. Pasuk Yud again reads, Daber al b'nei Yisrael le'mor. Speak to Yisrael and say, Ish, anyone ki yet tamei la'nefesh, if he's tamei, o b'derech rechoka, or far away, Lachem o l'doraseichem, for you or for your generations. Ba'asa Pesach Lashem. So that's the interesting expression here, because it seems to just benignly slip into the pasuk here, is Lachem o l'doraseichem, for you or for your generations. Well, generally mitzvahs in the Torah are for you and your generations. But you could say perhaps Pesach Sheni, we might think it's a one-off. But the Pasuk emphasizes, Lachem el Dorseichem. It could just say L'Dorseichem. And that subsumes Lachem. It's obviously for now as well. What then is the Pasuk teaching us by emphasizing that what we're saying here is equally appropriate for you and for your generations? Says Be'er Basadeh, I have a simple question. One of the two people that are qualified for Pesach Sheni is someone who is far away. Why is he far away? Well, maybe he lives far away. That might happen in Eretz Yisrael. Everybody spreads out. But could you explain, please explain to me, says the Be'er Basadeh, how anyone was really that far away in the Mishkan, in the Midbar. I mean, they're all surrounding the Mishkan. And how far can you be already? No one is as far as Modi'in, that's for sure, unless they're lost, in which case they have other problems. So we have an interesting situation, because on the one hand, you're talking about someone who's Derech Rechoka, and this applies to you as well, but no one is Rechoka in the Mishkan. No one is Rechoka in the Midbar. Says Be'er Basadeh, what do you see from these words, Lachem L'Dorseichem? That even in the Midbar you can be far away. Because you're not very far away, but you just didn't get to the Mishkan for whatever reason. You see that it's not about long distance, because everyone was within range in the Midbar. And still there was a concept of Derech Rechoka for them. That's a good point. And moreover, the Pasuk says, Lachem L'Dorseichem. As surely as in the Midbar, Rechoka doesn't mean literally far. The same is true L'Dorseichem. It doesn't mean literally far. That's Rabbi Eliezer. That's Pshat. So these are very interesting approaches. Again, from Maskil David, you take Pasuk Yud and Yud Gimel, Derech Rechoka versus Derech. And what do you get from that? For the Be'er Basadeh, it's Lachem and Derosechem. We're comparing far away in the Midbar versus in Eretz Yisrael. What do we learn from that? I will add, though, and it's an important part of the Parshanut here, this question of Lachem L'Dorseichem is addressed in a completely different way by the Chasam Sofer. In the Tshuvos, this is in Or HaChaim Simen Kuf Mem Aleph, and in an explanation, if we watch carefully the Pasuk here, we will see that he employs one of the classic Parshanot models, which Rav Kupperman would refer to as ABAB. And the way to describe ABAB is that the Pasuk often will introduce two ideas and then will qualify them respectively. Which means the Pasuk may have four phrases in it, but they're not linear. They're not two follows one, three follows two, four follows three. But rather, you have one and two, and then parts three and four should be lined up parallel to one and two, because they qualify one and two respectively. That's A, B, A, B. Okay. For a classic example, just to initiate ourselves into this type of idea, the Pasuk says, with regards to the Mishkan, Avnei Shoham v'Avnei Miluim, La'efod v'la'choshen. Shoham stones and miluim stones for the ephod and the choshen. So we have two things, two types of stones, and then two types of garments, and they line up in that way. The first thing is avnei shoham, second avnei miluim. So the first garment is for the first stones, la'efod, and the second garment for the second stones, v'la'choshen. That's how it goes. Well, so Chasam Sofer says, wonderfully, there are two conditions, that is to say, two states that the Pasuk describes. One's called Tame, and one's called Derech Rechoka. There are also two time frames that the Pasuk presents. One's called Lachem, and one's called Derosechem. Says the Chasam Sofer, Lachem and Derosechem qualify Tame and Derech Rechoka. As if to say, if you look at the Pasuk in this light, again, Pasuk Yud, Daber b'nei Yisrael l'mor, ish, any individual, Ki ye tomei lenefesh. He could be tomei lenefesh. That's category one. O, alternatively, derech rechoka. Now, where could these two apply? The pasuk proceeds to qualify. With regards to the first category, tomei, that's lachem. That can happen to you. But the second one can't, because no one's far away. But the second one, O b'derech rechoka, can happen. O l'doro seichem. The two O's, they designate that the second state, which is O derech rechoka, is for O l'doro seichem. In future generations, where people can actually be far away, then that would apply. As opposed to this time, where the only really state that could disqualify you is Tommy, because no one's really that far away. And that is the, that's the Chasam Sofer's approach to lachem O l'doro seichem. Very different, in fact, than the Be'er Basad. Well, who is our third approach to explain, once again, our mission, to understand why Rashi sided with Rebbe Eliezer, that far doesn't really mean far. And the Ramban charged against him, it's not pshat, rechoka means far. Says Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrachi, Rosh HaMedabrim, the foremost amongst the commentators on Rashi, Rashi is responding to pshat of the pasuk. Not in a later pasuk. And not in a later phrase. In the words derech rechoka. Why? Says the Mizrahi. Because there's a dot on top of the hay of rechoka. And Rashi addresses it. Now, that's a very simple-sounding thing to say. But really, at the heart of what's, one could say, at the heart of what's being debated here between Rashi and Ramban is how to relate to the dots. And there are a few places in the Torah where there's dots around. You'll notice Rashi always comments. There's dots on Vayishakehu, Rashi's comments. There's dots on Vayomer Elav, for the Malachim with Avram, Rashi comments. And so on and so forth. Anistoras lanu levanenu, there's dots there, Rashi. He always comments on the dots. But what does that tell us? Seemingly, Rashi and Ramban, and Rashi's goal is pshuto shel mikra. Pshuto shel mikra. However, the question is, what is mikra? According to Ramban, mikra are the words. And therefore, anything which is not a word is not part of pshat. According to Rashi, mikra is the script. Whatever's written in the Torah, whatever meets the eye, is mikra. And if there's a dot there, you have to address it. And that's part of a straightforward response to what the Torah is saying on a most straightforward level. And therefore, because Rashi is responding to pshuto shel mikra and the dot's there, so you can't ignore it. And therefore, that's why he sides for pshat reasons. But it's an amazing situation because it's only once in a while that we really see such a reduced machlokas as to the question of what the word mikra even means. But that seems to be what's happening here. So these are some of the discussions that take place with regards to derech rechoka. As we said, it's just a couple of words, but it generates quite a bit of discussion already from the Tanoim down through Rishonim, down to the Acharonim Mefarshei Rashi. Okay. The second half of Parshas Balosacha, I think it's fair to say, is somewhat mystifying. A few things seem to go wrong, and it's difficult to know why. And then other things are generated by that, and it's difficult to see how things are related. Certainly one of the more opaque sections of the Chumash Bamidbar, if not the entire Torah. And we begin with the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. Well-known psukim with well-known features. Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph, at the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, so we need to backtrack to psukim. And when we do, we'll meet psukim that we say the whole time. Vayhi ben Soah Aaron, is the penultimate pasuk of Perek Yud, and then Avinucha Yomar is the final pasuk. And we cannot fail to notice they are surrounded, they are literally bracketed on either side by those famous backwards, upside-down nuns, the nunin hafuchin. And once again, Rashi comments, because it's another example. A backwards nun is not a word, but it's written in the Torah, which means you've got to respond to it. It's part of your basic response to what the Torah writes. And the Torah writes, there's backwards nun. And that's why Rashi famously says, quoting the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Kuf Tet Vav, that these two psukim shouldn't, so to speak, should not be here naturally. They actually belong somewhere else. They belong earlier in Bamidbar. This is the most unusual situation. This is not their natural setting. They were inserted here. They were, in our terminology, lahavdil, cut and paste from earlier on in by the Torah, from earlier on in Chumash Bamidbar, and placed here. Why? Says the Gemara, in order to distinguish, in order to divide more correctly, to separate between Poronos le Poronos, between two calamities. There is no other situation like this in the entire Torah. I mean, they travel in casing by these two backwards nuns so that you should know that they are, so to speak, artificially placed here by the Torah with the goal of prizing apart two situations of calamity. What's fascinating is, and it's mutter to say it, the Gemara says it, that in the future, when the world reaches its state of rectification, these psukim will once again be replaced in their natural setting. So says the Gemara. But in the meanwhile, they're here, and they're here for a reason. What purpose actually this section serves to prize apart two calamities is another question. Meaning, if they followed each other chronologically, then that doesn't change just because you put something else in between. That's a separate discussion. However, this helps to alleviate or ameliorate the situation. So be it. But that's why they're here. And now, the question is, what are the two calamities? What are the two Poronos? And Rashi comments, not here, Rashi here just really refers us to the Gemara, but Rashi in the Gemara says, the two calamities to be divided between are, number one, the misononim, right, that brief section that people were complaining, and the much longer section of Kivros Hatava, all right, his Abutava, they desired a desire, and that which led them to meet, and it's over the course of a good 20 or 30 psukim, all to come. That is Rashi's comment. Once again, these psukim, these two psukim, they're like a mini capsule to a mechitza, to divide between two Poronos, and says Rashi, Poronos number one, misononim, number two, kivros hatava. Those are Rashi's words. And Rishonim, beginning with Tosfos, Ramban also raise a very disturbing question on Rashi. And that is, these psukim do not divide between those calamities. Because these psukim feature at the end of Perek Yud. Those two calamities are then mentioned successively in Perek Yud Aleph. It's a very difficult situation. Because according to Rashi, if you're looking to prize apart, and you can understand that you would, but if you're looking to prize apart Misona and Kivros Hatava, the place to put them is not before, they're both recorded, it's in between them. In between Pasuk Gimel and Pasuk Dalet, that's where you should have, between Misona and Kivros Hatava. Well, and Rashi again has his commentators to explain exactly what he means. Tosfos part ways with Rashi, and Tosfos say, if this mechitza, as we're calling it, partition section, is coming to divide between two calamities, it must be that it serves to the first calamity is the one before it, and the second after it. But what is before it? All it says is the Jewish people traveled away from Har Sinai. as which they were told to do. Says the Tosfos, yes, they were told to travel away from Har Sinai, but the way they left was a disaster. In the words of the Medrash, Kitinok habareach mibeis hasefer. Like children, the way they bolt from school. If you're ever around when school is out, it's not safe to be outdoors. And that's how they left. And that's Tosas' approach. And therefore, these two psukim, but Vayibi and Soa, the two backwards nuns, before them is Vayis Umehar Hashem. That was calamity number one. They left in the wrong way. And after that is the Mesononim. And therefore it's in place. Now, Tosfos' approach, while it resolves the basic question, is not without its own difficulties. Because, yes, okay, according to your analysis, it's placed perfectly between what came before it and after it. There's just one question. Look at the Parsha. How can you call leaving Har Sinai a little bit too quickly? How can that rate as Peronus, as calamity number one, when it will be followed by two massive disasters called Misononim and Kivra Satava? With all due respect, it doesn't stand up to them. It doesn't equal them. It doesn't register with the same level of severity. The only thing they ever did wrong was they left Har Sinai a little too quickly. You have the luxury, quote unquote, of calling that a calamity. But set against things to come, and you call that a calamity? That's not paying due attention to the calamities to come. Now, if we put that question to the side just for a moment, and have a look at Pasuk Vav, we see that, and we're in Kivra Satava already, from Dalet to the end of the chapter is Kivra Satava. We see that the target, so to speak, is the man. Somehow, the complaining in Kivra Satava, it focuses on the man. They say, Nafsheni Yevesha Ein Kol, our soul is dry, we have nothing, built here the man Einenu. All we have is man. Now, Chazal themselves raise a question in the Gemara, in Maseches Yuma, and that is that, you know, the man is actually quite a good thing to have, because it can taste like whatever you want. So essentially what they're saying is, we just have this one thing, which can taste like anything. So that's good. Sounds like you have everything. As a complaint, it seems to take the wind out of their sails a little bit. What's to complain about? Now, again, and this is a well-known idea, the man could taste whatever a person wanted to taste of. If you look in Pasuk Ches, you will see it describes how they would collect the man. Shatu ha'am, velaptu, they would spread out, they would collect, v'tachanu b'rechayim, and they would grind with mills, odochu b'medocha, or with the pestle and mortar, uvishle papor, and they would cook, v'asu asu ugas, make them into cakes, v'haya tamo ketam l'shat ha'shamen. It was like a honey wafer. Or like a wafer with oil, pardon me. Okay. Now what's interesting is, how do we reconcile this pasuk which tells us what the man tasted like, if we just were informed that it tasted like whatever you want it to taste like? That doesn't seem to go well together. Unless you say, perhaps as a straightforward response, what if a person doesn't know what they want it to taste like? And a person doesn't always know what they want it to taste like. Especially if their wife isn't with them. They don't know what they want. So there has to be a default. The default is described in Pasuk Ches, if you had no thoughts on the subject, it's not tasteless. No, it tastes like that. But if you had an active thought, it would taste like whatever it is that you want. That I think is the simple response to that question. Pasuk Yud is a difficult pasuk. Vayishma Moshe es ha'am bochel mishpachosav. Moshe hears everyone. They're crying. in their families. Each the Pesach Olah, each one in the entrance of his tent. Vayichaf Hashem Ma'od. Hashem became, so to speak, very angry at this. Uve'enei Moshe Ra. And it was bad in Moshe's eyes. What's so difficult about this pasuk is that I don't think we ever find this. Presumably Moshe's views are aligned with those of Hashem to the extent that if Hashem is angry, then presumably it's because it's a bad thing. We don't need to be told as an extra piece of information. Not only was Hashem angry, indicating that this was not a good situation, but Moshe also did not really think this was a very good situation. Well, presumably not. Because he is Ish Elokim. Which means if it's not good, if Hashem thinks it's not good, then Moshe presumably thinks it's not good. And we never find this anywhere else, that we have separate record of what Hashem reacted, so to speak, and how Moshe reacted. But you have it here. Vayichraf Hashem uve'enei Moshe ra. Something else. Moshe's, as he proceeds to react, he starts to complain. And we see the ensuing psukim. That's what makes this parsha so difficult. Nothing here seems to have anything in common, even with other disasters. Vayomer Moshe l'Hashem, lama harios al avdecha? Why have you done evil to your servant? V'lama lo matzasi chen be'inecha? And why do I not find favor in your eyes? Lasumis masa amazeh, kol azeh alai. I can't feed them like this. Where am I going to get meat for them? I can't do it. It's too much. And so much so, in Pasuk Tesvav, Vim kacha atosali hargeni na harog. Do me a favor. If you ask this of me, then just kill me. Imatsasi chen be'inecha, val erib, I just can't bear the situation. We never find anything like that anywhere else. Well, what's Hashem's response to that? Hashem says, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayom Hashem Moshe, Esvali Shivim Ish Mizikne Yisrael, gather together 70 people, elders of Israel, and they'll help you. Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'yoradati V'dibarti Marsham, I will speak to you, V'ataltim Min HaRuach Asher Alecha V'samti Alehem, and I will spread the spirit that I bestow on you to them, and they'll help you. Benasu itra b'masa am, they'll help you carry the burden of the people. V'lo tisa ata levadecha, you won't have to bear it by yourself. Now, this seems to not really be a response to what Moshe was complaining about. Because Moshe is saying, where am I going to get meat for them? And the answer is, make a Sanhedrin and they'll help you guide the people. But what's that got to do with providing meat for Bnei Yisrael? It doesn't seem to be a commensurate response. So these are very, very, some of the basic questions that we need to ask about this mystifying parsha of Kivros HaTava. And the approach that we will take is that of the Malbim. And the Malbim and others concur, it's important to see this perspective, to see this approach. Moshe is the leader of the people, and we know, moreover, that he provides for the people in the sense that their very food comes to them in his merit. That the Gemara says in Tanis, three parnesim tovim, and Moshe, the man falls in the merit of Moshe. But what's important to realize is if the man falls in, if your food comes in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu, that means there's something about your food which is Moshe Rabbeinu-dik. That means that it's if he is the conduit, which allows for this to happen, through which to happen, means it partakes of the quality of Moshe. And that's why the man was such a spiritual food. Because it came through Moshe, the most spiritual of all individuals. And moreover, because that's true, that there was something about the man. The level of the man depended on the level of the person. The man did not, the circumstances which surrounded the people being fed by man varied from person to person. You had to really have an affinity with Moshe Rabbeinu in order to get everything the man had to offer. In two respects, we see this in the Gemara itself. The Gemara famously says, again, in Yuma in the 8th Perek, that the question of how close the man fell to your house was a function of how well you'd been behaving. Which means if you were a tzaddik, And if you were on par, it would fall on your doorstep. If there was a little to be desired, it will fall down the road. And if there was a lot to be desired, it would be out in the sticks. My father once told me, the pasuk says later on in Akev, Vayancha vayarivecha vayachilcha saman. Hashem, he made you hungry, he gave you the man. If he made you hungry, he said, if he gave you the man, why are you hungry? He said, some people prefer to go without. They couldn't bring themselves to walk to where their man actually was, which means that when they woke up and everyone came out, there was no man at their doorstep, and people said, where's your man? Is that their choice? Yechab shoin geessen. I ate it already. I did a vasikin. I ate my man already. Meanwhile, it's languishing out there somewhere in the wild. Yeah. So it wasn't easy. Moreover, the Gemara also says that for those that were tzaddikim, the man required no preparation. But doesn't our pasuk said you had to grind it and you had to cook it? What? Who's that for? If the person was below par, they needed to prepare the man. It didn't come ready to eat. But the final distinction, which is not in the Gemara, I have not seen it in another source, that doesn't mean much, but the Malbim stated it could be the chiddush of the Malbim. This idea that the man could taste like whatever you wanted to taste was only true for the tzaddikim. But if a person wasn't a tzaddik, in the same way that it could fall far away and he has to prepare it, he didn't have that luxury quality of tasting like whatever you want. It had the default taste, and it tasted like the same thing. And that's why the first people to complain were those whose behavior had them having man tasting the same thing every day. And they are called the asafsuf, right? They're the hangers-on, right? They're the people whose behavior is not the best. Vasasuf pasuk dalit, vasasuf asher b'kibo. So they just want normal food because the man tastes like the same thing for them the whole time. But then it spread, of course. Whereas pasuk dalit starts with the asafsuf, but before the pasuk is over, Bnei Yisrael are also. Mitzvah gereres mitzvah. Once the asafsuf start complaining, everyone starts complaining. Because they really resonated with a part within even other elements of the Jewish people. They didn't want to have to be on par. They wanted maybe to a bit of hefkerus. But it shouldn't compromise their menu. And really, therefore, at the heart of what's behind the complaint about the man is they were complaining about having to live a lifestyle which would allow them to get the most out of the man. Perhaps they were okay to let their standards drop a little bit. And that's why when they say in Pasuk Hei Zachanu Es Hadaga Eshenocha B'Mitzrayim Chinam, we remember the fish we used to eat Chinam, aside from the issues that, how do we know that they had fish for free? We don't know they had anything for free. But the Gemara darshans famously, Chinam in a mitzvahs. They longed for the food of Mitzrayim because there was no strings attached. You just had to eat it, and that was it. You didn't have to deserve it. You didn't have to be on your best behavior. Chinam in a mitzvahs. It's an amazing thing. You have, on the one hand, the pshat. Once again, the pshat of chinam just sounds like it's free. But the drash says, free of any associated requirements. Chinam in a mitzvahs. And that's really what it's about. In the very wonderful formula of Nechama Leibovitch, as she discusses, the pshat says you didn't have to pay for it. The drash says you didn't have to behave that well for it. Says Nechama Leibovitch, ha-pshat yira le'enayim, va-ha-drash yira le'levav. The pshat is what the eye meets, but the drash goes for the heart. In other words, it sounds like they're saying we didn't have to pay for it, but really what's at the heart of the matter is that we didn't have to be on a standard in order to merit it. And that's why they're complaining. And it was wrong for them to complain, because they're basically complaining about the regimen of Torah, which is expressed in the man. But beyond that, beyond Hashem becoming angry, so to speak, it was bad in Moshe's eyes. Why is it bad in Moshe's eyes? Because Moshe is the one who feeds them the man. And the man comes down in keeping with Moshe's spiritual level. And that now is a disconnect Because if they're not able to handle, if they're looking for food that is more physical in nature, that means that in order to provide for them, Moshe will need to become more physical in nature. And he doesn't want to do that. And that's why he says, what have I done that in order for me to provide for the Jewish people, I need to step down from my level and become more gashmiistic in order to provide for them food that's more in keeping with what they would like? And that's why he has a very painful request of Hashem. He says, you know, it could be they need another leader, because there's just too much of a discrepancy. And therefore he says, he's not just saying, I've had enough, kill me. But he's saying that I would prefer that someone else take over, who can feed them on their level, but I'll gladly hand over the reins to him. But I don't wish for after everything that I worked for to go down again in order to be the leader that can provide for them in that gashmius way. That's what's behind Moshe's own distress here. And what's the answer? The answer, amazingly, is Hashem says, you know what we'll do? Get 70 men around you. Get 70 people around you. What are they? How does this answer anything? Until now, you have been leading the people by yourself. And it's you and them and nothing in between. And you have your level, and they're struggling to keep up, whether for better or for worse. For worse. And therefore, what we need is to buffer almost, or to absorb the spiritual input that comes to you on your level. It needs another attachment for this conduit in order to reach the people on their level. You're Isha Elokim, right? You're a godly person, you're elevated beyond everyone else. We need people who are on a level between you and the people. And they'll be attached to you, and through them, as the Pasuk describes, when I speak to you, then v'atzalti min haruach, that will filter down, it will trickle down, in which case leadership now has 71 people. And those the 70 who are not you do have much more in common, gashmius-wise, with the people. And that's how you will still be the leader. But there'll be a way to format somehow the Shefa as it comes through you to the people. And this is really how what Hashem is saying is a response to Moshe's complaint. What's very fascinating is that it did change things for Moshe. Because the Gemara tells us that Moshe has the status of 71, a Sanhedrin of 71. There is a very interesting comment of the Tosfos of England, Tosfos Chachmei Anglia, who we have there. There were Balei Tosfos in England, and we have the Chiddushim on certain Masechtas. In Masechta Sanhedrin, Tosfos Chachmei Anglia say, from the time that Moshe gathered 70 people around him, he was the head of the Sanhedrin, but he was no longer the equivalent of 71. Because leadership has now been shared in that way. He's the head of the Sanhedrin, but that's really what happened. And thus we have Moshe continues as the leader of Bnei Yisrael, but you have these other people, and through them the Shefa comes down. The result here is a disaster, ultimately, for Bnei Yisrael, because they asked for things in completely the wrong way. But the leadership has changed from this point onwards. We'll leave it over there for this evening.